This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Jordan Peele, who is half of the comedy duo Key and Peele. Peele wrote and directed the new film Get Out, and he just became the first African-American writer-director whose debut film earned more than $100 million at the box office. Get Out has some pretty funny moments, but it's a horror film with racial anxiety at its center. And for those of you who haven't seen it yet, I promise no big spoilers. Get Out is about a young African-American photographer, Chris, played by Daniel Kaluuya, who's dating a white woman, Rose, played by Allison Williams. They've been together for a few months. Rose decides it's time for Chris to meet her parents, but she says she hasn't told her parents that Chris is black. Don't worry, she reassures him, they're not racist. In fact, her father would have voted for Obama for a third term. Chris is not reassured. When they arrive at Rose's parents' house, the parents, played by Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener, go out of their way to be friendly and to show how much they appreciate black culture. But there's something suspicious beneath their genial, liberal surface. At first, Chris thinks maybe he's paranoid, but as the film goes on, he realizes he's in danger. Reviewing the film in the LA Times, Justin Chang wrote, "This is surely the nerviest, most confrontational treatment of race in America to emerge from a major studio in years, and it brilliantly fulfills the duty of both its chosen genres, the horror thriller and the social satire, to meaningfully reflect a culture's latent fears and anxieties." Let's start with a scene from early in the film. Chris and Rose are on the way to her parents' home in an affluent suburb. She's driving when the car hits a deer. They pull over. A police officer arrives and asks Chris for his ID.
Sir, can I see your license, please?
Wait, why?
Yeah, I have state ID.
No. He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Yeah, why? That doesn't make any sense.
Here.
You don't have to give him your ID because you haven't done anything wrong.
Baby, it's okay. Come on. Anytime there is an incident, we have every right to ask.
Cool.
Ma'am,
everything all right, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm good. Get that headlight fixed. And that mirror.
Thank you, officer.
Jordan Peele, welcome to Fresh Air. I should mention we can't see Chris, the boyfriend, the African-American boyfriend, cringing and trying to, like, disappear during that scene. What are some of the things the Allison Williams character did wrong?
Well, you know, part of the scene is about the white girlfriend who's dating her first black boyfriend getting woke to a certain racial dynamic for the first time. So, you know, part of this story is watching her wrestle with the racial implications of all these interactions that she's never really had to wrestle with before. For Chris, or for, you know, African Americans in this sort of situation or other situations that arise later, the experience and the perception of the racial undertones is an everyday experience.
So you call your new movie a social thriller. Is that your coinage, social thriller?
It is. It is.
I like it. Why did you need a new term? Why did you need that term?
Well, you know, people who watch this film tend to have a hard time describing what genre it is as well. And I sort of knew that. It's not, you know, we sort of market it as a horror. And I'm a huge horror fan. And I think you could put together a really good argument that it's a horror. But you could also put together an argument that it's not. That it's closer to a psychological thriller or something. But because it's not about the psychology to me as much as it is about society, I call it a social thriller. It's in the same vein to me as like the Stepford Wives.
So why the idea of the white girlfriend with the black boyfriend bringing him to her parents?
At some point I realized that the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was really the perfect starting point for this film. I think one of the reasons that film was it resonated so powerfully is that it's a universal situation. Take race out of it, we can all relate to the fears of meeting our potential in-laws for the first time and the the feelings like we might not be what is expected. So I just thought it was a great entry point to help make this movie inclusive, to help make it something that you don't have to be African-American to emotionally connect to the main character here.
And the parents, when they meet the Allison Williams character's boyfriend, are trying to be like so cool with the fact that he's black. They're masking any discomfort they might feel by being like overly jokey and overly friendly. And you can really sense this discomfort. But they're very like liberal and open-minded, or at least they think they are. And so I want to play a scene, and it's a little hard to make out what they're saying because there's a lot of jokey asides here, but you'll get the kind of tone of it. So
yeah.
Allison Williams has just brought her boyfriend home, played by Daniel Kaluuya, and the parents, played by Catherine Keener and Bradley Whitford, are, you know, again, trying to be like super friendly and cool. And Bradley Whitford, the father character, speaks first, and what he's asking here is like, so how long have you been together? So here we go.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? How long?
4 months.
4 months?
Mm. 5 months, actually.
She's right. I'm wrong.
Attaboy. Better get used to saying that.
Please, I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. She's right. I'm wrong. See?
Does he have an off button? This is exhausting.
I know, and I want to give you a tour.
Can you, like, unpack first?
You want to unpack? Before the tour?
Okay, I love the way Bradley Whitford says, this thing.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah.
He really got it.
Yeah, so you obviously wanted to put in things that white people sometimes say to black people to make them think like they're really aware of and in sync with African-American culture.
Yeah, you know, a part of being black in this country and you know, I presume being any minority is constantly being told that we're being too aware of race somehow. We're obsessed with it, or we're seeing racism where there just isn't racism. So it was important to me to, first of all, put the entire audience on the same page of what it feels like to be aware of these little subtle interactions. So, I sort of teach the audience early on that, you know, Chris, played by Daniel Kaluuya, he's nervous about meeting these parents because he's nervous that she hasn't told them that he's black. From that point forward, any little, whatever you want to call it, microaggression, you know, sort of lame reaching out to make a connection, it becomes aware to the audience, and we get the giggles of awareness from audiences.
So again, you've made a kind of horror film that plays on real racial fears and stereotypes and discomforts. And the movie starts with a young African-American man on the way to visit his girlfriend in her suburb. And he's totally geographically lost. The streets all look the same. Her address is on, I think, like Edgewood Street, but Edgewood Street is right near Edgewood Lane. And he's wondering, like, who does that? Who puts Edgewood Street close to Edgewood Lane? How can you possibly know where you are? And he's a little nervous, especially when a car passes him by and seems to be slowing down and watching him. And you know that this character is thinking about Trayvon Martin. And you know most people in the audience are probably thinking about Trayvon Martin. But you don't have to mention Trayvon Martin's name in this. And you don't.
Right. This scene, for me, is the entry point into allowing a non-black audience to relate to real fears that we experience. I think after this scene, for the rest of the movie, everyone knows that there is a threat of racial violence just around the corner. And that is the state that black people have when they feel like they might be perceived as the outsider in the wrong neighborhood. So it's very important to me to just get the entire audience in touch in some way with the fears inherent of being black in this country. as a starting point.
So in horror films, usually like the main character has seen something nefarious or is being hunted by a monster or an alien, but no one believes them. And the main character starts to question his or her own sanity. And that kind of happens in your movie Get Out, but it has all these racial overtones to it. And I think it's interesting that you're using this form, this genre, to get at that feeling of uncertainty, of not knowing what someone has just said or done actually has a racist overtone, or maybe you're overreacting, maybe you're projecting something that isn't fair, you know, because there's that constant uncertainty until we really know what the story is.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the...
Do you experience that a lot, that uncertainty? Like, I don't know if that person said is kind of racist, or am I just, like, projecting that on them? I mean, I've experienced that as a woman a lot. Like, that thing that guy just said... Is that really sexist, or does he understand what he just said? You know,
that's exactly right. I think we're wired at this point to look for these interactions and to wonder and to sometimes you know, to call them like we see them. But we're also, you know, I think any minority, women, gay people, you know, we're constantly told we're not seeing what we are seeing. You know, I'm glad you brought up gender, because this thing you're talking about is also present in The Stepford Wives.
You know, I've never seen that. Should I see that?
Oh, you should. If you like Get Out, you should absolutely see it. It's one of the most well-crafted social thrillers that there is. And in it, much like in Rosemary's Baby with Mia Farrow, the protagonist is in this state you're talking about, where it's crazy enough that something awful might be going on, but it's also real enough that something just normal and awful might be going on. And so what ends up happening is we see that state that you've described as being part of being a woman, I describe it as being part of being African-American, is being told we're not seeing what we think we're seeing. It's a perfect state for a protagonist of a thriller, because it helps keep the character in this unfolding dire situation longer, because she can sort of mentally justify why this might be, you know, something that they're overreacting or going crazy about.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing. I wanted to make a movie that satisfies an audience's need for a character to be smart.
As we've been talking about the film, it's very much a kind of thriller about race. And I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but I want to find a way of talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
The white people in this movie they're very upper class. They're very kind of outer suburb, you know, outer ring of suburb, and they're basically living very much in their own bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And when the young man, the African-American protagonist, arrives with his white girlfriend, and they're at a party here, you know, at her parents' home, the white people there are very kind of admiring of this young man because of certain qualities that they feel black men have. You know, black people are faster, they're cooler, they're mm-hmm. stronger, they're athletic. And mm-hmm. all the white people there kind of want to kind of be close to him and have some of that rub off on them.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you have the sense that they would like black people to be exactly like white people, so that they're not posing any kind of challenge of being different. They're not challenging the norms that the white people have in any way. And I guess I was wondering if there's anything you wanted to say about that, about this sense of both like admiration and envy, and at the same time, but be just like us.
Yeah, you know, it's a tricky part of the African-American experience. And it's interesting because these are the type of things that really happen all the time, all day long. And it's very low key. And, you know, when you compare it to the more violent, hateful versions of prejudice, it's, you know, it's these are meaningless, seemingly meaningless interactions. You know, but this movie was, you know, I kind of was coming up with it in the post-racial lie America. Okay, that's what, you know, I think I've been calling it when, you know, Obama was elected and all of a sudden we weren't addressing race, or there was this feeling like, hey, if we stop talking about it, it'll go away. There was even this, you know, some notions that like, hey, Obama's blackness was, you know, helped him become president. That's why he became president. You know, so there are these little, you know, notions and these little racisms that on one level sound okay, but if you dig a little bit deeper, there is a denial of the reality of the African-American experience and the horrors attached to them. So, the point in this movie, I wanted to point out how, you know, these seemingly harmless, again, like, you know, I don't love the term microaggressions because it just seems so kind of clinical and I don't know. It seems weird to me. But these microaggressions are proof to me that racism is still very much alive in this country. And, you know, they're one side of the same monster that ends up killing black men at the hands of police, or the mass incarceration of black people.
How did being biracial figure into writing the screenplay? Because, you know, we're talking about tensions between black people and white people. Your father was African American. Your mother is white. So in some ways, like, you've lived in both worlds. Like, you're no stranger to either world. And I imagine, like, a lot of people have, like, a dual consciousness that might be particularly pronounced in you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you probably nailed it. You know, it's like, it is kind of living in two worlds as far as the country's need to identify us, or the human need to categorize us and identify us. You know, I'd been taught from an early age that I was in the other category on the standardized tests. You know, I had to go down the checklist: Caucasian, African American, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, and then, you know, at the bottom is other. So, you know, very early on, I was taught in a way that I was somehow this anomaly. And, you know, it's hard. I might be too close to it to really be able to tell you how all of that went into the movie, but it very clearly did.
What impact did it have on you as a kid to be told to check the box other?
You know, I not a pleasant one. I think in some ways it felt, you know, even as a young person, you sort of felt like, okay, well, first of all, there's a weird hierarchy going on because this is a list and it's put in some weird order. I don't know if it was what the point of the order was. Or if I got the order correct. I think I did. But, it's probably one of the reasons that I fell in love with horror and comedy, which I think are genres that really appeal to someone who identifies with the outsider or the other, which is many of us. But, yeah, it was, I remember it being a very confusing notion. You know, we were on one hand learning about Martin Luther King's dream, and then on the other hand, we were having to fill in these boxes and declare what we were. By the time I was a little older, maybe fourth, fifth grade, I would check the African American box, which I think, you know, brought me comfort to, you know, be able to identify with a group more, which is sad. You know, it's all very sad, but, you know, definitely by the time Barack Obama was elected, it changed a lot of my feelings of identity, and was one of the, you know, really inspired both Key and Peele and Get Out. All of a sudden, being mixed was an identity, and one that was the identity of, you know, a man who I consider the very best of us. So I feel like the discussions about, you know, being biracial just weren't even in existence. And so when Barack Obama was elected, it definitely inspired us to explore that, then the notions of code switching and everything, and Key and Peele, and Barack Obama election very much inspired this movie as well.
You've said that you knew by the time you were 13 that you wanted to make a horror film. How did you know that?
I was a very scared child. Not so much of life, but of the demons that lurked in the dark. And horror movies terrified me. You know, I'd love watching them, but then at night I would just be up in sweats all night. At some point, I swear, Terry, it was like my mind just shifted in order to cope with these fears. And, you know, I sort of became obsessed with this idea of mastering my own fear, that if I could do what these, you know, great horror people did, that I would be wielding this power as opposed to being a victim to it. That's what happened. I fell in love with horror films.
So I have to let you go, but one more question before you leave. I know your wife is pregnant. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you trying very hard not to think about Rosemary's Baby, which is one of your favorite films?
I'm trying to I'm just trying to be very receptive and understanding and supportive and to not to be as far from the John Cassavetes character as possible.
Yes, tell her to avoid anyone who offers her tannis root.
That's right. No tannis root. No weird drink concoctions. We're just gonna play it safe.
All right. Jordan Peele, thank you so much, and congratulations on the success of your film and
thank you.
On your forthcoming baby.
Thank you. And the sex, too, that created the baby. That was... thank you. It's all a first time for me. All first time.
Are you nervous?
I am nervous, but, you know, I figure it's kind of like directing. I feel like You're never really ready, and at this point, if I'm not ready, then who is?
You made a film. You can do anything.
That's right. We'll see.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Jordan Peele wrote and directed the new film Get Out. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album of compositions inspired by Thelonious Monk, written by pianist Frank Carlberg. Even on Carlberg's first recordings back in the 90s, he played Monk compositions. Carlberg was born in Finland, educated in Boston, and lives in New York. Kevin says Carlberg's big band takes extended flights on familiar Monk themes.
Dry Bean Stew by Frank Carlberg's large ensemble with Michael Serene on drums. It's from the album Monk Dreams, Hallucinations, and Nightmares, a set of meditations on Thelonious Monk's odd but catchy melodies. Dry Bean Stew, for instance, fixates on the opening of Monk's I Mean You. Carlberg quotes and paraphrases so extensively from the Monk tunes that inspire him, you might fairly hear some of these pieces as elaborate arrangements of Monk rather than new compositions. But however you classify them, Carlberg opens these melodies out with a masterful control over the flow of the material and some artful transitions. The band is tight too. This is from the same piece. John Carlson just getting warmed up there on trumpet. Composer Frank Carlberg also loves Charles Mingus's impassioned orchestra music and nods to him, too. Carlberg's bustling Sphere echoes Monk's Straight No Chaser, but the alternately loose and tight horns and abrupt change-ups are right out of Mingus's playbook. That's Chris Washburn on trombone. Few pieces on Frank Carlberg's Monk Dreams, Hallucinations, and Nightmares are less tethered to Monk's music. A couple are vocal settings of his pithy sayings, including this one: "It must be always night, otherwise they wouldn't need the lights." That Monkism had been jotted down by saxophonist Steve Lacy, and Carlberg's melody nods to Lacy's settings of poetic texts. The singer is Christine Correa. As the band's pianist, Frank Carlberg does a little monkish bonking, but mostly avoids aping his distinctive touch and timing. Carlberg is less fascinated by Monk's piano here than by how his composed lines move with their own internal logic. The piece International Man of Mystery references Monk's Mysterioso. Kirk Konufke there on cornet. He also gets an extended feature on the one Monk tune that appears under its own name, Round Midnight. Thelonious Monk's 100th birthday is coming up in October, and there will be many more tributes this year. His influence is everywhere. And as Frank Carlberg reminds us, his melodies are hard to resist.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Tone Audio and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Monk Dreams, Hallucinations, and Nightmares by Frank Carlberg's Large Ensemble. Our next guest, the Irish writer Sebastian Barry, won the Costa Book of the Year Award for his new novel, Days Without End. It's an award given to writers based in the UK and Ireland. He's the only author to have received it twice. Days Without End follows the life of Thomas McNulty, who flees the Great Famine of Ireland as a boy and winds up a soldier on the Great Plains of America fighting in the Indian Wars, and later in the Civil War. McNulty's plight was not uncommon for Irish immigrants of the 19th century. Many were conscripted right off the boat as the price of citizenship. McNulty finds companionship and love in one of his fellow soldiers, Handsome John Cole. That part of the novel was inspired by Barry's son, Toby, who came out to him a few years ago while Barry was researching the book. Barry dedicated Days Without End to his son. Sebastian Barry spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with a reading from the book. Days Without End is narrated by an elderly Thomas McNulty, recounting events from 50 years ago. Barry read this passage in character.
Chapter 1. The method of laying out a corpse in Missouri sure took the proverbial cake. Like decking out our poor lost troopers for marriage rather than death. All their uniforms brushed down with lamp oil into a state never seen when they were alive. Their faces clean shaved, as if the embalmer sure didn't like no whiskers showing. No one that knew him could have recognized Trooper Watchorn because those famous Dundrearys was gone. Anyway, death likes to make a stranger of your face. True enough, their boxes weren't, but that was not the point. You lift one of those boxes and the body makes a big sag in it. Wood cut so thin at the mill was more a wafer than a plank. But dead boys don't mind things like that. The point was, we were glad to see them so well turned out. I am talking now about the finale of my first engagement in the business of war. 1851 it was, most likely. Since the bloom was gone off me, I had volunteered age 17 in Missouri. If you had all your limbs, they took you. If you were a one-eyed boy, they might take you too, even so. The only pay worse than the worst pay in America was army pay. And they fed you queer stuff till you just stank. But you were glad to get work, because if you didn't work for the few dollars in America, you hungered. I had learned that lesson. Well, I was sick of hungering.
And that's Sebastian Barry reading from his new book, Days Without End. Sebastian Barry, welcome to Fresh Air.
I'm delighted to talk to you.
Your book deals with the American expansion west, the Indian Wars, and the Civil War. Why did you want to take on such a formative part of American history?
Well, the whole adventure of these 7 books, indeed, has been to try and go and find, if only in the imagination, these bits and bobs of my family, the people who weren't talked about, the people who around whom a silence fell, whether for political reasons or because they went so far and never came home. And this was one person that my grandfather told me about when we shared a bed and a room when I was small in the 1960s in Ireland. And he'd tell me these wonderful stories. And this was a story he couldn't tell because all he knew about it was that a great uncle of his had been at the Indian Wars. So that's where that started. And I've been thinking about that for, well, nigh on 50 years and what that means. And when I first heard it, I thought, well, I know what that means, aged 8, because I've been to all the cowboy films up in the Adelphi Cinema in Dunleary, so surely I do know what he's talking about, and that was a very exciting idea. But later you wonder then about the sadness and the sorrow, historical sorrow, of an Irish person, himself essentially a native person, an Aboriginal person, by a great trauma having to go to America, joining an army that was engaged in the destruction, erasure and removal of a people, the Native American people, not unlike himself. So that was one of the things. So my task was to follow him, in this instance, follow a person like that to America. But I have to say, it was a joyful undertaking.
And Thomas joins the army. Was it common for Irish immigrants then to join the army?
It was almost absurdly common. I mean, not only then in the 1840s, but I was quite shocked just because I didn't know it. And maybe it is to some degree shocking that just later on, because, you know, after we talk about the million who died in the famine, the million who left, but in the next 20 years, another 2 million left. Mm-hmm. Many, 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 many hundreds of thousands for America. I mean, hundreds of thousands. The numbers are just staggering. But if you were of military age as a young person, a young man from Ireland getting off the boat in America, you were immediately put into the Union Army if you landed in a Union port, and mm-hmm. vice versa in a Confederate. This was to earn your citizenship. I mean, this was something I simply didn't know. So a person who has lost everything behind him, his future, the people who loved him, the people he loved, his whole possibility of meeting some girl someday in a, you know, a hawthorn-strewn country road, and marrying her and having his babies and all the rest of it gone for all eternity, is then put straight into a uniform, given a musket and told to go and fight
for something he didn't understand? Mm-hmm. Was he even speaking English? And secondly, in a country he knew nothing about, a total tabula rasa picture with nothing drawn on it. I mean, it is quite astonishing. But also for a novelist, I mean, for a human being, that's quite frightening. But for a novelist, of course, that's possibly wickedly a wonderful thing to think about and to try and tackle in a book.
I was surprised at how much famine there is in the novel. I mean, not just in Ireland, but in the West among both the Native Americans and the soldiers. And then there's this haunting scene in a prisoner of war camp in the South during the Civil War, where both the Union captives and their guards are all starving.
Yeah. You know, some of these, I mean, if I had a private title, it would be Book of Revelations for this book, because all that astonished me, you know, as Irish people. Only reading Irish history, sometimes we think we have the copyright on hunger. And, you know, and in a way, rightly so. But it is an illusion. I mean, we have the history of Bengal, we have the history of China, we have all these other histories of hunger. But even in America, do you know, if you were a group of Sioux people who decided to submit to the government and try and do what they were being asked to do, you know, first of all, the rations given to you were disgusting more often than not. But if they didn't arrive, you and your people were going to start starving out there on the plains. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the word hunger, because Thomas has lost his family. His family have died on the stone floor of his house. His mother and his sister and his father have all died of hunger. So he knows what hunger is. So he notices hunger. And I was noticing hunger, as you say.
Well, one of the things that sustains him through all this carnage, and one of the most endearing parts of the book, is the relationship that Thomas McNulty has with his lover, handsome John Cole. And, you know, they maintain this clandestine romance as soldiers in the army, and then they have a domestic life together. You know, I found it interesting that you decided to write a book about a gay relationship in an era where even that phrase would have been a foreign one. I mean, did you have to research about what it was like to be gay in America in the 1800s? Are there any primary sources about that? Do you have to sort of read between the lines of diaries?
Between the lines and maybe 10 feet under them? Mm-hmm. Because understandably, it's not in the record. You know, I mean, it's often said that if you look for Jesus Christ in the historical record, there's two vague mentions of him there. Mm-hmm. That's it. And for, you know, for living a life that is gay, as you say, a word that didn't exist, when your whole purpose is to be at least discreet and protect each other and watch out for dangers, it's not going to be written down somewhere unless things go badly wrong. At the same time, there is a certain amount of record. And, you know, you read the, for instance, I wrote a play about Hans Christian Andersen, which was sort of the same period in Denmark. Hans Christian Andersen, I mean, Hans Christian Andersen may have died a virgin, but he was certainly incredibly in love with a young Danish actor, and that's recorded, and he was in love with the son of his patron, Colin, and was distraught and almost self-destructive when he was turned down by this man. And, you know, and from the beginning of time, and it led me to think that, you know, being gay has been part of what we are as a human creature ever since the dawn of time. So where is the history? You get a little bit of history from San Francisco in up to 1863, for instance, when dressing as a woman was outlawed, of parties that were just for men, of events that were just for men. And in this world of America in the 1850s, where there are no women, more or less, just about the west of the Missouri or the Mississippi, it's well said in a particular book I was reading that men occupied not only public spaces usually occupied by women, but also domestic spaces, which is a very interesting idea. But the immense discretion required. I mean, Thomas, if I'm putting him through anything, I think he put himself through all these things. But say, as a writer putting him through these things, I thought if he has to go through the Indian Wars and the Civil Wars, you know, I was very relieved that he was able to get through that particular war of being allowed to be in love with John Cole and live a life with him, and try to create a little family with the Sioux girl Winona. I mean, that also heartened me as a human person. The possibility of it, you know.
Right. They adopt a Sioux girl, and have family together that's as you say, very heartening. I read that when you were first working on this book, you weren't planning on writing about a gay relationship. What changed?
Well, I couldn't have because I just wouldn't have known anything. But, you know, Toby, my lovely son Toby, just a few years ago, he was only 16, and I was just beginning the book, became very, very unhappy. And, you know, when our young men become unhappy, we've got to mobilize ourselves. You've got to really try and find out. I mean, in a way, you can't ask directly because that could be more distressing. You've got to be a kind of super Sherlock Holmes of this unhappiness. It could be something tiny. It could be something huge. Anyway, eventually, on the advice of his elder sister, who is the philosopher in our family, she sent him in to us, me and Ali, my wife, and Toby came in and he said, "The thing is, Dad, I'm gay." I was so profoundly relieved. I don't ever remember such a release of happiness because I thought, oh, my God, is that the reason? Thank God you told us. And I said something bats to him, absolutely nuts. I said, well, thank God, Toby, you won't have to go through this heterosexual nightmare we've been struggling with all our lives. Something mad like that. And Toby laughed and we laughed. And I tell you, it was the beginning of a sort of university of information, of observing him. I mean, he is a beautiful child and he's a wonderful man. He's full of music. He's composing since he was six. He's the most vital person you can imagine. And to have this pall of worry lifted off him was a true instance of freedom in my understanding of the world. And you know, in his great kindness and empathy for his poor, ignorant, straight father, he took it on himself to instruct me somewhat. And we sat through our 20 hours of RuPaul's Drag Race so he could show me what was what. And, you know, and I just thought recently, if you wanted a reality TV star for a president, why didn't you choose RuPaul? I think she would have been a much better choice, but let's leave that there. Anyway, Toby was magnificently informing, and I saw the nature of his love between him and his boyfriend, and I thought, this is not something just to be tolerated. This is something to be revered, emulated, cherished, something we can learn from, because the delicacy of their love, it seemed to me at that age, was far beyond the capability oftentimes of straight people, who often it becomes the battle of the sexes from the get-go.
Well, in 2015, there was a referendum in Ireland on whether to make same-sex marriage legal, and you wrote a letter to the newspaper The Irish Times in support of the referendum. I think you have the letter there. Could you read it to us?
I will, and I just say very quickly, if it ever is likely that I will say anything quickly, and forgive me my long answers to things, but I thought I had to do something, and it is the default action of the middle-aged Irish Catholic person to write to the Irish Times, so that's what I propose to do. And, you know, as if that could change anything. But, you know, maybe it could. But I had to read it out to him. So the only other time I've read this out is to Toby in my workroom when I wrote it to get his approval. And he wept, you know, and he's a very strong young man. He's very mensch-like. He never cries. And I thought, well, maybe it's all right then. And it went viral around the world and was read out in the Australian Parliament. We were proud to note, you know, as to try and get things going there in Australia. But anyway, here's the little letter. Sir, as the more than proud father of one shining person who happens to be a member of the LGBT community, I will be voting yes in the coming referendum. In that sense, it is a personal matter. I have read quite a bit in the papers about our new, more tolerant society, and that may be so, and of course it is a solid point of view from which to vote yes, but I don't see it as a matter of tolerance so much as apology. Apology for all the hatred, violence, suspicion, patronization, ignorance, murder, maiming, hunting, intimidation, terrorizing, shaming, diminishment, discrimination, destruction, and yes, intolerance, visited upon a section of humanity for God knows how many hundreds of years, if not millennia. My child will be just shy of 18 when the votes are cast, and therefore cannot vote himself. By voting yes, I will be engaging in the simple task of honoring the majesty, radiance, and promise of his human soul.
We were talking about the referendum to make legal same-sex marriage in Ireland, and that referendum passed by, I think, over 62% of cast votes. And Ireland became the first country to legalize same-sex marriage by popular vote. Were you proud of your country then?
Oh, man. I'll tell you. There was a funny moment in Philadelphia when I was doing an event with John Banville, who's, of course, a great man and calm to being as it happens. And I had been in a bit of trouble in Ireland with a play. I don't need to go into it, but... And if somebody in the audience said, well, how do you feel about your country now? You know, because there had been calls for Mr. Barry to possibly to leave the country and all the rest of it. And I instinctively said, well, I love my country. See, I love my country because I know my country. I know the thing that I love. I'm not loving unconditionally or blindly. I've tried to look into the whole matter. And I remain in love with this strange land and its people. But that moment, and it was, you know, the vote that really carried the vote, as it were, was the vote of the inner city people of Ireland, who you might think to be quite conservative. But no, they, you know, on the news programs, they were saying, oh, no, yes, it's time. Anyone, look, people should be able to do what they want now. It's time people were free of these sort of things, and it's totally unacceptable, and we're voting yes. I mean, when I heard that, I wasn't just proud of my country. I was crazy proud of my country.
Well, Sebastian Barry, thanks so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure, Sam.
Sebastian Barry is the author of the new novel, Days Without End. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.